Good afternoon. I apologize that Doug and I are both feeling some ill effects of the bizarre weather we've been having, so we'll try to get over the hoarseness and coughing. Today we celebrate Douglas Laycock's appointment as the Robert E. Scott Distinguished Professor of Law. Let me first say a word about the chair itself, which was established in 2000 to honor our former colleague, Bob Scott, who was not only an exceptional dean of the law school from 1991 to 2001, but is as responsible as anyone for the law school's enviable position in American legal education. This room was part of the Law Grounds expansion that took place under Bob's deanship, funded entirely with private giving in the law school's first capital campaign. The Robert E. Scott Distinguished Professor, Doug Laycock, has the distinction of being one of the nation's foremost experts in two separate areas of law, religious liberty and remedies. Indeed, Steve Smith, himself a distinguished law and religion scholar, identified Doug as, quote, the preeminent lawyer scholar of religious freedom over the last quarter century, close quote. Doug is a graduate of Michigan State University and the University of Chicago Law School. He began his teaching career at Chicago and then moved to the University of Texas and the University of Michigan as the career of his spouse, Teresa Sullivan, who's here with us today, rose to ever greater heights. Her appointment as president of the University of Virginia in 2010 bestowed an enormous positive externality on the law school as Doug joined our faculty. I can't hope to do justice to Doug's scholarly influence and accomplishments without keeping you here all night, so I will have to be content to mention a couple of things that I have learned from Doug's scholarship. Doug is known for his thoughtful, although controversial, formulation of the concept of government neutrality in religious matters. A central problem in the law of religious liberty is whether the state should exempt particular individuals or organizations from generally applicable regulations in order to accommodate religious beliefs or practices. An example we've all read about recently is whether the government should exempt certain employers from regulations requiring that employer-provided health insurance cover the cost of contraceptives. Doug's solution begins from the proposition that the First Amendment's religion clauses are fundamentally about liberty, liberty of belief and of non-belief. He denies that government adequately protects religious liberty through formal neutrality or the mere lack of religious classifications in a statute or regulation. Rather, he argues that governments must be substantively neutral in the sense of neither encouraging nor discouraging religious belief and practice. To do so, religious organizations will sometimes have to be treated differently than secular ones. But Doug recognizes that this is not the end of the analysis. Claims of religious exemption, he notes, cannot automatically trump the government's desire to regulate. Sadly, in Doug's view, I cannot stop paying taxes by claiming I have a religious objection to doing so. Instead, the trick here, as in so many other areas of law, is to consider the magnitude of the harm done to a believer or religious community and the less harmful alternatives available to the government. But substantive neutrality also requires that the nature of the exemption not be such as to encourage religious practice by those otherwise disinclined, as my hypothetical tax exemption undoubtedly would. Doug is the rare law professor who is equally at home in an appellate courtroom as in the classroom. Most recently, as most of you know, he applied his scholarly work on religious liberty in an amicus brief on behalf of the American Jewish Committee in Hollingsworth v. Perry and United States v. Windsor. The brief argued that civil marriage must be made available to same-sex couples. At the same time, it argued that religious organizations must be free to retain their own definitions of marriage and to refuse to recognize same-sex couples as married for purposes of those organizations' own rituals and provision of social services. Doug's writings on religious liberty, currently being edited into a four-volume collection, make him one of the most influential scholars of his era. But he is also the author of one of the most penetrating and important books ever written about remedies. The students in the audience who took my contracts course will remember how we struggle with equitable remedies in contracts. Law and equity have been merged, but not completely. We still cling to the view that equitable remedies are special and to be used only sparingly. Most notably, equitable remedies are described as being available only when the legal remedy of money damages is inadequate. In his 1991 book, The Death of the Irreparable Injury Rule, Doug argues that law and equity have merged in fact and should merge in principle even more than we appreciate. Surveying more than 1,400 cases, Doug argues convincingly that the irreparable injury rule, or the requirement that money damages be inadequate to remedy the harm done, does not have a real-world impact on case outcomes. Like many other doctrines, the irreparable injury rule is used to justify outcomes reached for other reasons. In this case, reasons having to do with the hardship an injunction would impose on the defendant, the court, or third parties compared to its marginal benefit to the plaintiff. Doug will speak to us today on religious liberty and the culture wars, and I am confident that we will see this timely and central topic more deeply and clearly after hearing him. Please welcome the Robert E. Scott Distinguished Professor of Law, Douglas Laycock.
By the end of class today, it was down to a croak, so I will apologize in advance and do the best I can. I think anyone who was anywhere in legal academia in the 1990s was hearing about Bob Scott and his ambitions for this law school and what this place was accomplishing under his leadership. And so there's a great honor and a bit intimidating to hold the chair that his friends endowed in his honor. It is a hard name to live up to. I will do my best. I begin today with a proposition that may be more controversial than it sounds. I believe that human liberty is a good thing, and especially with respect to matters that are deeply personal. And therefore, I believe that the free exercise of religion is a good thing, and that control of our own sex lives is a good thing. I do not intend to defend those propositions more than incidentally. What I want to do today is to examine the political conflict between them. Religious liberty is one of America's great contributions to the world. Religious liberty has largely ended religious warfare and persecution in the West. It has enabled people with fundamentally different views on the most fundamental matters to live together in peace and relative equality in the same society. It has enabled each of us to live, for the most part, by our own deepest values. Religious liberty includes the right to believe whatever you choose or whatever you find believable about religion, or to dismiss all religious claims as not believable. And according to the Supreme Court, the right to believe is absolute. Religious liberty also includes the right to speak about your religious beliefs. And more controversially, religious liberty includes the right to practice a religion, to engage in religiously motivated behaviors, in the language of the Constitution, to exercise a religion. A right to believe a religion but no right to act on it would be a hollow right indeed, and even Justice Scalia, when he narrowed the free exercise clause in Employment Division versus Smith, explicitly agreed that religiously motivated actions are the exercise of religion. But actions are necessarily subject to regulation. All of us impose costs on our neighbors with everything we do, but there must be limits. We have no right to impose significant harm on others, even in the exercise of a constitutional right. So religious liberty with respect to actions can be protected, but it cannot be protected absolutely. Sometimes religious actions are protected simply by not regulating. The practices of politically dominant religions have never been unlawful. Some actions are generally unlawful, but when those actions are done for religious reasons, they are protected by exemption from regulation. And sometimes that is entirely uncontroversial. It is unlawful to give alcohol to children, but no one thinks that should apply to communion wine or to Seder wine. And that kind of regulatory exemption has been part of the American experience of religious liberty since the 17th century. The Carolina colony exempted Quakers from swearing oaths in 1669. Rhode Island exempted them from serving in the militia in 1673. And conscientious objectors to military service have been exempt from the draft in all of America's wars. In colonial Massachusetts, Quakers were first executed, later flogged and escorted to the boundaries of the colony, eventually tolerated, and then, very quickly in the wake of toleration, given regulatory exemptions. Even the colony with the worst history of intolerance quickly realized that religious liberty must extend to religious actions. Protecting religious liberty reduces human suffering. People do not have to choose between incurring legal penalties and surrendering core parts of their identity. And religious liberty reduces social conflict. There is much less reason to fight about religion if everyone is guaranteed the right to practice his religion. Well, there were only a few of these conflicts between law and religion in the founding era, but as regulation grew more pervasive, and as the population grew more religiously diverse, the number of conflicts grew, and so did the number of religious exemptions. The most visible Supreme Court case, Employment Division versus Smith, holds that the Free Exercise Clause creates no right to exemption from a neutral and generally applicable law. But what is a generally applicable law? Consider Smith's new rationale for an earlier case, Sherbert versus Verner. Sherbert held that a worker who lost her job for refusing to work on the Sabbath was constitutionally entitled to unemployment compensation. The state required her to be available for work or to lose eligibility, but that rule about being available for work contained, quote, at least some exceptions. And therefore, the court said in Smith, the Constitution requires a religious exception as well. The implication is that even rather narrow secular exceptions make a law less than generally applicable. And the only subsequent Supreme Court case casting any light on what they mean by generally applicable law is Church of the Lukumi Babaluaye versus City of Hialeah, where local ordinances singled out a religious practice for regulation that applied to essentially no one else. Not surprisingly, the court said those ordinances were not generally applicable and that they did not come close. For judges who carefully parsed the two opinions, the result has been an unusually protective form of equality rule. A law that burdens the exercise of religion cannot have any exceptions or any gaps in coverage that allow secular conduct to cause the same harm as the regulated religious conduct. That would be to treat religious conduct unequally as compared to the unregulated secular conduct. And that inequality must be justified by a compelling interest or remedied by a religious exemption. Judges more guided by the tone of the Smith opinion assume that most laws are neutral and generally applicable and that all the court statements suggesting otherwise don't really count. There's a cert petition filed yesterday that addresses that conflict. There's a separate branch of constitutional doctrine that protects the right of religious organizations to govern their own internal affairs, unanimously reaffirmed just a year ago in Hosanna-Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School against the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Every state constitution also protects religious liberty. 13 states have interpreted their state constitutions to protect religiously motivated conduct even from generally applicable laws. Only 6 states so far have interpreted their state constitutions to mean something like the rule of Employment Division versus Smith. There's also a vast body of statutory law on religious liberty. 20 years ago, Jim Ryan, our colleague, estimated that there were about 2,000 religious exemptions in state and federal statutes. That is a ballpark number based on sampling techniques, but it indicates the longstanding legislative response to the need for exemptions. Jim's search was motivated by a new kind of exemption statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. There is now a federal RFRA for federal law, 17 state RFRAs for state law. And these statutes say that government may burden the exercise of religion only if necessary to serve a compelling government interest. And absent a compelling government interest, the religious claimant is entitled to an exemption. All in all, this is a substantial body of law providing for regulatory exemptions for religiously motivated conduct. It is also a confusing and a rather ragtag body of law. 23 years after Employment Division versus Smith, there are still fundamental questions about what the opinion means. Whatever Smith means, Congress in 30 states have adopted more protective rules, either by statute or by constitutional interpretation. On the other hand, this body of state law has been little used and little tested, and about much of this law, there is an air of under-enforcement. All of this law has become far more controversial than it used to be. When Congress passed the federal RFRA in 1993, it acted unanimously in the House, 97-3 in the Senate. But 4 years later, in City of Bernie versus Flores, the Supreme Court held the federal RFRA unconstitutional as applied to the states. Congress immediately set out to enact replacement legislation under other constitutional powers, but that proposed legislation was soon mired in partisan deadlock, principally due to energetic demands to carve out all civil rights claims. By 2000, Congress abandoned the effort to enact a broad replacement for RFRA. It enacted what it could agree on, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which protects the religious liberty of prisoners and mental health patients and of religious organizations in the zoning process. The larger question is suggested by the failure of the broader bill. We had gone from 97-3 to partisan gridlock in just 5 years, and disagreement over religious liberty has gotten progressively worse ever since. Large social and political developments of that sort obviously have multiple causes, but the biggest problem for religious liberty in our time is deep disagreement over sexual morality. Under that heading, I will cluster disagreements about abortion, contraception, emergency contraception, sterilization, gay rights, and same-sex marriage. After the Supreme Court announced the constitutional right to abortion, the pro-choice movement tried to force all hospitals to perform them, including religious hospitals. The pro-choice side had some occasional successes in the lower courts, but Congress responded with legislation to protect the rights of conscience. No medical provider can be required to perform or assist an abortion, not hospitals or other organizations, not doctors, nurses, or other individuals. The pro-choice movement does not much like those rules, and they are sometimes under-enforced. But the exemptions have persisted. Congress seems to treat the issue as settled, and nearly all states have similar legislation. There is no such equilibrium with respect to the more recent conflict over same-sex marriage. The disagreement over marriage equality begins with a disagreement over marriage and over the nature of marriage. Marriage is both a legal relationship and a religious relationship. And the secular side sees the legal relationship as primary. Committed religious believers mostly see the religious relationship as primary. They see legal marriage as built on a foundation of religious marriage. And so they see same-sex marriage legislation as the state interfering with the sacred, changing a religious institution. They reject the change, and they reject the state's authority to make the change. We need to much more cleanly separate legal marriage from religious marriage, but that is not easily done, legally and especially culturally. The two relationships are deeply entangled. So both as organizations and as individuals, religious conservatives focused on the religious relationship refuse to participate in same-sex weddings or commitment ceremonies. Some churches will not make their space available. Some clergy will not perform the ceremony. Some individuals in the wedding business will not assist with the ceremony or with the reception. Conservative Christian counselors will not counsel same-sex couples. Catholic adoption agencies will not place children with same-sex couples. The refusal of some small businesses to assist with same-sex weddings does not entail any claim of a right to refuse to serve gays and lesbians as individuals. The religious liberty claim here rests on the view that marriage is inherently religious. These merchants refuse to facilitate, validate, or recognize a relationship that, in their view, is inherently religious, falsely mimics a religious relationship, but is in fact religiously prohibited. Where conservative Christians see a protected exercise of conscience, gays and lesbians see discrimination that is or should be illegal. They mostly concede, either genuinely or tactically, that the clergy should not be required to perform the wedding ceremony. They sometimes acquiesce in bills that protect religious organizations in contexts beyond the ceremony itself, but they have kept those exemptions narrow, and they have fiercely and successfully opposed any kind of exemption for individuals in the wedding business. Most of these battles have been fought in state legislatures. Only a few scattered cases have squarely presented claims to religious exemptions. At least two claims by graduate students dismissed from or disciplined in counseling programs have settled. The case of a wedding photographer who refused to photograph a same-sex commitment ceremony is pending in the Supreme Court of New Mexico. There are other examples somewhat further afield, and no doubt there are others that have not come to my attention. And the brief that Paul mentioned was aimed at that issue and suggesting that if the court takes responsibility for marriage equality, then it has to also take responsibility for the resulting religious liberty issues. The Affordable Care Act reopened a long dormant battle over contraception. The Catholic Church has long taught that artificial contraception is immoral. Most Americans, and indeed most Catholics, have rejected the Church's teaching as incomprehensible and wrongheaded. But in the middle of the 20th century, the Church's teaching was enforced by law in some states. And as you all know, in 1965, in Griswold versus Connecticut, the Supreme Court held those laws unconstitutional. And the Church acquiesced. There was no rear guard resistance to Griswold, of the sort that faced the court's decisions on abortion or school prayer or government religious displays or many other controversial issues. From 1965 to 2012, the situation with respect to contraception neatly illustrated the live and let live solution to such deep moral disagreements. The great majority thought that contraception is morally permissible and they used it themselves as needed, but they made no effort to force that view on the minority that disagreed. The minority that disagreed thought contraception was immoral and refrained from using it, but they made no effort to force that view on the majority. Each side allowed the other to live by its own values. The Affordable Care Act disturbed that equilibrium. The act includes preventive reproductive care in the minimum standards for all health insurance plans. And under the implementing regulations, Catholic institutions are required to arrange for, contract for, and pay for insurance coverage that would include sterilizations, contraceptive drugs and devices prohibited by Catholic teaching. The bishops responded that Catholic institutions could not, in conscience, provide that coverage. The minimum coverage provision also includes emergency contraception. In most Americans, emergency contraception is simply another form of contraception. But to much of the pro-life movement, both Catholic and evangelical, emergency contraception is sometimes a way of inducing abortions. And that belief cannot be dismissed as a product of the religious right's fevered imagination. The FDA-approved label for these drugs says that they act by preventing ovulation, that's just contraception, and that they may sometimes also act by preventing implantation of a fertilized egg into the wall of the uterus. For those who believe that a new human life is created at the moment of fertilization, preventing implantation is a form of abortion. And it doesn't matter that the drug works that way only sometimes, or that the FDA says only that it may work that way sometimes. If I hand you a gun and say it might be loaded, but don't worry, it probably isn't, not one of you would take the chance and fire that gun at another human being. And for just the same reason, if you really believe that human life begins at the moment of fertilization, you will not take the chance. Catholic and evangelical institutions will not pay to make available a drug that may act in a way that, in their view, destroys an innocent human life. So there are now dozens of pending cases around the country seeking exemption from the obligation to provide contraception, the Catholic cases, or emergency contraception, both the Catholic and the evangelical cases. Plaintiffs are religious institutions and, in a more difficult set of cases, closely held corporations controlled by religious individuals. On February 1, the Department of Health and Human Services proposed new regulations that attempt to sever the connection between the religious institutions and the mandatory insurance coverage. Churches, associations of churches, and their integrated auxiliaries are entirely exempt. The exclusively religious functions of any religious order are entirely exempt. At the other end of the continuum, there is no exemption of any kind for any business covered by the Act. Other not-for-profit religious organizations would be entitled to self-certify themselves as having a religious objection to one or more drugs, devices, or procedures. They are told to send the self-certification to the insurer that covers their insured group or to the plan administrator that administers their self-insured plan. The insurer or plan administrator is then required to promptly and automatically issue or purchase individual policies, one for each member of the insured group, covering only the items listed in the religious institution's self-certification. This individual coverage is to be issued without anyone applying for it, without charge either to the religious institution or to the insured individuals. It is to have no deductibles or copays. It is to be accompanied by a notice explaining that the coverage comes from a separate policy that is, quote, not in any way connected to the group policy provided by the religious institution. Whoever laughed is not the only one who has laughed. This is a serious effort, but the early reaction from religious groups indicates that this solution is not yet acceptable. The claim that the individual coverage is not in any way connected to the group policy is obviously a fiction. The individual policies are available only to those who are covered by the group policy. The coverage is arranged for and initially paid for by the insurer or the plan administrator on the group policy. The self-certification of religious objections is in form a statement that the religious institution refuses to supply certain drugs. But in practical effect, it is a legally binding command to provide individual coverage for those drugs, no less effective for not being explicitly stated. Can at least be said that the religious institution is not paying for these drugs? I think so, but the devil's in the details. When the health insurers bid for the business of a Catholic or evangelical institution, they know with a high degree of certainty this customer is going to self-certify its religious objection to certain drugs. They know that the insurer who wins the account will be required to provide those drugs at no additional charge. It is hard to believe the insurers will not take account of that cost when they bid the plan. Insurers who participate in federally facilitated exchanges under the Affordable Care Act would be allowed to credit the cost of the individual contraception policies against the fees they pay the exchanges. This appears to be an effective means of spreading the cost of contraception, but you would want to hear that from a healthcare expert and not just from me. In states that create their own exchanges, it appears there will be no federally facilitated exchange, but the insurer can claim the credit with a federally facilitated exchange in another state. It has also been suggested, at least in the media, that contraception coverage pays for itself by saving the much greater cost of pregnancy, prenatal care, and childbirth. But if these savings from averted pregnancies for some equaled the cost of covering contraception for all, then we might have expected insurers to cover contraception voluntarily. For the most part, they did not. I don't know why not, but it is easy to think of possible reasons. If most people will get some means of contraception on their own, then the insurer doesn't have to pay for pregnancies or contraception. And if most of the savings come 9 months later, the employer may have switched insurers in the interim so that the savings from contraception don't necessarily match up with the cost of contraception. Whatever the reasons, insurers have not covered contraception voluntarily, and there was no broadly effective requirement that they do so until the Affordable Care Act. Well, there is no free lunch. We have to assume that covering contraception costs money. Health and Human Services has offered a serious plan to shift that cost away from religious institutions. It would help if the two sides would work out the details together. The comment period just ended. Any signs of the two sides trying to work things out are not apparent, at least to me. Let me shift gears for a minute. A few years ago, I was asked to compare the French and American law of religious liberty. I learned that the Marquis de Lafayette took the language of our First Amendment, home to France. The fundamental French provision on religious liberty guarantees free exercise of religion, abolishes all establishments of religion, and is captioned separation of church and state. From those common beginnings, France and the United States have come to opposing answers on every important issue of religious liberty. And many of the French answers are outside the range of the American debate. There is no right to religious exemptions in French law, and few, if any, legislated exemptions. France can, and sometimes does, single out religion for discriminatory regulation. French schoolgirls can wear a headscarf for fashion reasons or medical reasons or any other secular reason, but not for religious reasons. Religious organizations in France must obtain licenses from the state, and on occasion, those licenses are denied. There are restrictions on religious speech, and especially on proselytization. The state owns most of the churches and pays for their maintenance, and it pays for religious schools. There is a central ministry of organized religions that negotiates the church-state relationship with officially designated representatives of various religious traditions. The whole body of law seems designed to keep religious groups dependent on the state and on a short leash. What accounts for these radically different outcomes. However disappointing to textualists, history and culture matter to constitutional interpretation. The biggest and most obvious difference is that in France, the church was on the wrong side of the revolution. The Catholic Church opposed not just the revolution's excess, but the revolution itself. And it supported repeated cycles of counter-revolution throughout most of the 19th century. The church was seen as opposed to the liberties of the people. It made itself the subject of enmity and of suspicion and of regulation. And the result has been a very narrow view of religious liberty in French law and in French public opinion. In the United States, it was the other way. The churches overwhelmingly supported the revolution. In the United States, religion and liberty were perceived as natural allies. In France, religion and liberty were perceived as natural enemies. And those contrasting perceptions have had very different consequences for religion and for religious liberty. So what if we had a new revolution in our time? The sexual revolution that accelerated in the 60s continues to make important gains, most dramatically with respect to same-sex relationships, and conservative churches in this country have persistently been on the losing side of that revolution, what the winners will call the wrong side of the revolution. They have opposed not just the sexual revolution's excesses, they have opposed its core. And each of the remaining sexual issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, contraception, sterilization, emergency contraception, has the same fundamental structure. What one side views as a grave evil, the other side views as a fundamental human right. For tens of millions of Americans, conservative churches have made themselves the enemy of human liberty. And in the view of the pro-life and traditional marriage movements, abortion and same-sex marriage are so wrong, they must be prohibited for everybody. And that means, in the view of pro-choice women, same-sex couples, and their supporters, that religious conservatives are attempting to interfere with the most intimate and personal of human decisions and to impose their controversial view of morality on the entire population. Most Americans are undoubtedly ambivalent about abortion, and polling data depends on how the question is phrased, but it appears that a majority do not want women trapped in unwanted pregnancies with no way out, and a substantial minority feel intensely about that. Support for gay rights in contexts other than marriage is becoming overwhelming. Support for same-sex marriage itself is growing with extraordinary rapidity. And there's a strong age skew in the data. The opponents of marriage equality tend to be older. The supporters tend to be younger. That clearly indicates the future direction of public opinion. For a time, religious conservatives dismissed the polls because they were winning all the referendums. But in 2012, they lost 4 referendums out of 4. The contraception issue is different in important ways. Nearly all Americans think they are entitled to use contraception and that it is no one else's business. And for the most part, they do not think that emergency contraception is a form of abortion. It is unimaginable that any American state would now attempt to ban contraception. The bishops gave up that battle long ago. Here, the source of friction is not a direct attempt to regulate other people's sex lives. Here, the friction flows from the religious liberty claim itself. Do religious institutions have to cover contraception for their students and employees? The churches, correctly in my view, see any requirement to provide contraception coverage as imposing secular morality inside religious institutions. The churches are not telling anyone what they can do with their own money, not even with the wages paid by the religious institution. These institutions are refusing to provide contraception coverage themselves. With respect to contraception, they would do nothing, neither provide it nor interfere with it. But of course, the other side doesn't see it that way. American law has bizarrely made healthcare an employer responsibility, and religious institutions are refusing to perform. Never mind that the employees signed on to do the work of the church and to further its mission, those demanding contraception do not see themselves as imposing secular rules on the church. They see the church as imposing religious rules on them. And once you reframe the conflict that way, then once again, the church is seen as interfering with other people's sex lives and with their healthcare too. Most of these issues can also be put in the frame of discrimination. Churches and believers discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation by not recognizing or facilitating same-sex marriages. They discriminate on the basis of sex by refusing to provide items essential to women's health care. They discriminate on the basis of religion by limiting membership in religious organizations to those who actually believe the religion. Imagine that. A religion that cannot make distinctions on the basis of religion is not likely to survive long as a religion. But never mind, a student religious group's statement of faith is religious discrimination in the view of many student affairs officers across the country. Discrimination is a powerful charge. It still contains some sense of the moral imperative associated with the civil rights movement in the 1960s, when the discrimination at issue was utterly indefensible by any measure. The issues involved in these religious liberty disputes are very different from the issues in Jim Crow, but the broad label discrimination makes no distinctions. The stakes in these disputes are very high. Many disputes over the free exercise of religion involve unusual practices of small religions, unusual laws of little importance, or both. But these disputes over same-sex marriage, contraception, emergency contraception, and abortion involve core teachings of large and mainstream religious organizations on one side and important government programs backed by powerful interest groups on the other. They present claims of fundamental right on both sides. The right to exercise one's religion and not to violate God's will as one understands it. The right to control one's own sex life, one's own body, one's own health care. It is a risky step to interfere with the most intimate details of other people's lives while loudly claiming liberty for yourself. If you stand in the way of a revolution and lose, there will be consequences. I do not offer a prediction. I identify what seems to me to be a very large risk. The consequence of fighting the sexual revolution so long and so hard may be to turn much of the country against religious liberty, or at least to turn public opinion towards a very narrow, more French-like understanding of religious liberty. Certainly in the short run, the conflict over sexual morality is making a large part of the population deeply suspicious of claims to religious liberty. The pro-choice and gay rights movements see their constituents, correctly in my view, as the targets or victims of religiously driven attempts to restrict abortion and same-sex marriage. And they respond with very negative views of their religious opponents. They see conservative believers as extreme and unreasonable. They see conservative believers as bigoted, a word they use mostly with respect to gay rights and same-sex marriage. Beyond that, many of them believe, and they occasionally say, that the religious side is evil. There's every reason to fear that the dispute over contraception is generating similar hostile attitudes. For too many on the gay rights, pro-choice, and women's health care side of these issues, the free exercise of religion begins to look like a bad idea. It is a bad idea because it empowers their enemies. It should be interpreted extremely narrowly, confined to a bare right to believe whatever crazy and bigoted things you may like, but it cannot mean a right to actually act on those beliefs, a right to exercise a religion. Here are two recent examples from the press. One, a columnist in the Toronto Globe and Mail. It is time to speak out against religious freedom. For the ardent religious believer in the organized hierarchical religious organization, religious freedom often refers to the right to restrict the freedoms of others or to impose one's religion on the larger world. And closer to home, the Colorado Senate just passed a civil union bill with no meaningful religious liberty exemption. And Senator Pat Stebman explained why, at least in his view. So what to say to those whose religion requires them to discriminate? I'll tell you what I'd say. Get thee to a nunnery and live there then. Go live a monastic life away from modern society, away from people you can't see as equal to yourself, away from the stream of commerce where you may have to serve them. No living in peace and equality in the same society for him. Religious minorities must withdraw or conform, and that from an elected official. I think for many people, this hostility to religious liberty is a growing intuitive reaction. They're tired of hearing from the Catholic bishops and evangelical preachers, tired of hearing about religion, tired of hearing about their claims to religious liberty, tired of them trying to restrict other people's sex lives. For others, it is a more thought-out position. The academic arguments against religious liberty grow more elaborated in the law reviews, more hostile in the listservs. Arguments created to win a particular battle about contraception or marriage are rarely limited to those issues. These arguments have obvious implications for other religious liberty claims, and if accepted by courts, they create precedents that apply to all religious liberty claims. I cannot offer a full analysis of the legal issues in these cases, but I do want to highlight the sweep of the arguments that are being made against claims to religious liberty. The interest groups now arrayed against religious liberty tend to assume that any interest they care about is a compelling interest, and to state those interests at the grandest level of generality. There's a compelling interest in women's health. There's a compelling interest in non-discrimination. Such sweeping claims avoid the proper inquiry, which is whether enforcement of the government's interest as applied to this particular religious claimant and to all others whose similar claims cannot be fairly distinguished is necessary to serve a compelling government interest. Not that that matters, because the opponents of religious liberty also insist that every individual application of their interest is compelling. There is a compelling interest in avoiding any inconvenience or affront. No potential customer should ever be referred elsewhere. They say there is a compelling interest in having personal services available even when the services are entirely unwanted. No same-sex couple in its right mind would want to be counseled by a counselor who believes that the couple's relationship is fundamentally evil. But supporters of gay rights insist that there's a compelling interest in requiring every counselor to commit to be available to same-sex couples. The purpose of such arguments is not to obtain counseling, but to derive conservative believers out of the profession. Same logic is applied to every other occupation or profession in any way connected to one of these disputes. If you don't want to do abortions, don't work in obstetrics and gynecology. You should not be permitted to deliver babies unless you are willing to kill them unrequested. If you don't want to do same-sex weddings, don't be a wedding planner or a caterer or the owner of a bridal shop, however small. In Washington State, Planned Parenthood and the governor's office spent years, 5 years, trying to find even one woman who was unable to promptly obtain emergency contraception when she needed it or when she claimed to need it as a test shopper. They never found a single case that stood up in court, but they're still litigating fiercely to require a handful of small pharmacies and individual pharmacists to stock and deliver emergency contraception. It is not to solve an access problem. It is to drive those pharmacies out of the profession. These interests are said to be compelling, and the law is said to be generally applicable, even if vast numbers of cases are exempt for secular reasons. To note just the biggest and most obvious exception, the Affordable Care Act does not apply to employers with fewer than 50 employees. That exempts some 25 million employees, or about a quarter of all non-government employment. The government asserts no interest at all in employer-provided contraception for a quarter of the workforce, but it allegedly has a compelling interest in refusing a much smaller exception for employees of religious institutions. Just as all government interests are compelling in this view, so no burdens on religion are substantial. Driving religious minorities out of their chosen occupation is said not to be a burden on religion because their religions do not require them to be a wedding planner or a marriage counselor or an obstetrician. Never mind that excluding Catholics from the professions was a time-honored means of persecution well known to the founders. All the Catholic bishops say it violates their religious obligations to arrange for insurance that covers contraception, but the critics say the bishops are mistaken. They may think they are so closely connected to the sin as to be morally responsible, but really, and even if they pay, the connection is pretty loose, and we can decide for them. We are told that Catholic teaching on contraception doesn't matter because most Catholics reject that teaching. Some of the deepest disagreements in Christianity have been about the forms of church governance, and it is absolutely clear that Catholic institutions are not run as democracies. Never mind, we'll take the Catholic teaching from the people and overrule the bishops, at least as long as we agree with the people. These arguments are made with no sense of any difference between commission and omission. Failing to provide a service is seen as doing affirmative harm, even if the service is readily available elsewhere. And these arguments are made with a completely one-sided sense of each side's turf. If we are to preserve liberty for both sides in the culture wars, then we have to preserve some space where each side can live its own values and where its rules control. Inside a Catholic institution has to be a Catholic space, but not in the view of the church's opponents. If your Catholic institution has employees, if it has students, it has forfeited its right to live by Catholic rules. If an individual provides any goods or services on however personal a basis, on however small a scale, he has crossed over to the other side's turf in the same-sex marriage debate and forfeited his right to exercise his religion. Arguments like this will not easily be confined to the bitter debates over sexual morality. Once formulated, once widely adopted in political debates, once accepted by at least some judges, they will be ready at hand for any other religious liberty dispute that may arise. These developments are mutually reinforcing with another that I lack the time to discuss today. Academics have begun to argue that special protection for religious liberty cannot be justified in a society with many non-believers. Now, I fully agree that non-believers have to be integrated into the system of religious liberty, and that that task is only partially completed. The rise of a new set of beliefs about religion and a new axis of religious conflict is a new problem for the law of religious liberty to address. It's the emergence of a new and more fundamental disagreement about religion, and it makes religious liberty more important, not less. But my point for today is more descriptive. Those who are opposed to religious liberty because churches interfere with other people's sex lives are likely to be attracted to this argument about non-believers. It has the potential to get rid of religious liberty once and for all. And those who are arguing that there is no justification for religious liberty will likely be attracted to arguments designed to minimize religious liberty so long as it survives. These developments are mutually reinforcing, and they are deeply threatening to the American tradition of religious liberty. Now, most religious liberty issues actually have nothing to do with sex or abortion or non-believers. They have nothing to do with the culture wars, except that the culture wars are eroding support for religious liberty. The United States is the most religiously diverse nation on the planet, and it is pervasively regulated by multiple layers and branches of government. And issues about the free exercise of religion arise whenever one of these diverse religious practices comes into conflict with one of these equally diverse laws or administrative practices. And very often the problem is not some conflict with a competing interest group, but rather bureaucratic rigidity and indifference. Bureaucratic rigidity is sometimes stiffened by a more generalized hostility to religion or to religious liberty, and that hostility is becoming more widespread because of the culture war issues. Even on the hot-button culture war issues, religious liberty provides a model for resolving or ameliorating social conflict. We could still create a society in which both sides can live their own values if we care enough about liberty to protect it for both sides. One of the ironies of the culture wars is the religious minorities and gays and lesbians make essentially parallel demands on the larger society. I cannot fundamentally change who I am, they say. You cannot interfere with my identity and the most fundamental things. You must let me live my life according to my own values, according to who I understand myself to be. And in all but a tiny fraction of these cases, the issue is not whether any other individual can obtain contraception or whether a same-sex couple can have a wedding with a full panoply of catering and clothes and photographs and flowers and all the rest. All those things are readily available in the marketplace in most of the country. The issue is whether the religious conscientious objector must be the one who provides those things. And if it is thought essential to provide contraception for free or very inexpensively, there are other ways to do it. The rebate of fees owed to the federally facilitated exchanges might actually work, or government could provide it directly, or we could require the pharmaceutical companies to sell contraceptives to individuals at the same price they charge to group plans. Any proposed solution will, of course, have political issues of its own, but the First Amendment does not say that government may interfere with the free exercise of religion whenever churches have less political clout than pharmaceutical companies or some other interest group. The Free Exercise Clause exists precisely because religious minorities often do not have the political clout to protect their own liberty. Well, as always, abortion is different. Hostile regulation has made abortion difficult to obtain in much of the country, but the statutory conscience protections for medical providers are not a significant part of that problem. Most abortions are provided in clinics, and the pro-choice movement wants it that way because moving abortions to hospitals would be vastly more expensive. Doctors and nurses with conscientious objections to abortion do not work in abortion clinics. Abortion is also a special case with respect to any possibility of a live and let live solution. The pro-life side sees it as killing innocent human beings. You cannot expect them to be live and let live about that. The moral imperatives on the pro-choice side are equally strong, but access to abortion for women who need them does not require compelling pro-life doctors and nurses to perform them. For the rest of these issues, live and let live solutions would be quite possible if either side would accept them. I obviously cannot tell believers what their religion requires of them, but I can sketch out steps that might help divert us from the path to a French view of religious liberty. The first step for the religious side would be to focus on protecting its own liberty and to give up on regulating other people's liberty. That is, the religious side would have to stop seeking legal restrictions on other people's sex lives. In practical terms, that means only one thing. It would mean giving up the fight against same-sex marriage now instead of waiting until the fight becomes hopeless. Every other form of non-commercial, consensual sexual behavior has been deregulated, either de facto or de jure, and religious conservatives have mostly acquiesced. There's no significant lobbying to enforce or reenact fornication laws, adultery laws, sodomy laws, laws against gay and lesbian sex. No-fault divorce is much lamented, but there's little effort to roll it back. Even the effort to restrict pornography has largely collapsed, with its energies redirected just to child pornography. On all these issues, churches teach what people morally should do, but they no longer seek to control by law what people may do. With respect to contraception, the bishops would be well advised to accept a compromise that gives them reasonable insulation from the provision of contraceptives, even if that insulation is not airtight. They might have separated out the issue of abortion and emergency contraception, where people can understand their argument and seek more stringent protections there. It may be too late for that now, but probably it is not. If they let the perfect be the enemy of the good, they may wind up with the very bad. Now, on the other side, the advocates of sexual liberty and marriage equality would have to agree to the same basic proposition, that it is far more important to protect their own liberty than to restrict the liberty of religious conservatives. They would agree not to demand that religious individuals or institutions assist or facilitate practices they consider immoral, except, and this is an important exception, except when the goods or services requested are not available from another reasonably convenient provider. Of course, same-sex couples should have a right to marry and to as big a wedding as they choose, and women should have a right to contraception, but apart from local monopolies, they have no real need to obtain those things from religious believers with deep moral objections. A corollary of that solution is that Catholic hospitals should not seek and should not be permitted to acquire local monopolies over women's health care. Those who seek to live by their own values should avoid acquiring monopolies that block that same possibility for others. Now, of course, this is all a thought experiment. There is no prospect whatever of either side agreeing to live and let live. Each side respects the liberties of the other only when it lacks the votes to impose its own views. Each side wants a total win. The mutual insistence on total wins is very bad for religious liberty. The religious side persists in trying to regulate other people's sex lives so long as it thinks it has any chance of success. That motivates much of the other side's hostility to religious liberty, and the other side persists in demanding not only the right to live their own lives by their own values, but also the right to force religious objectors to assist them in doing so. And to that end, they are making arguments calculated to destroy the American tradition of religious liberty. Maybe this too will pass. Maybe the courts will do their job and protect the liberty of both sides. Maybe the sexual issues will eventually be resolved, passions will cool, and a strong core of religious liberty will survive for application to other less emotional issues, or maybe not. Religious liberty is at risk, and that would be a loss for America, whichever side of the culture wars you find yourselves on. Thank you.